It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
John Sadek is about to start his third season as the lead play-by-play broadcaster for the Cincinnati Reds Television Network, and he is with us today. He has worked with the CBS Television Sports, Westwood One Radio. His work includes play-by-play in the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, college football, basketball, and baseball, as well as college softball, soccer, lacrosse, ice hockey, volleyball, water polo, and field hockey. He spent nearly a decade as the voice of the Princeton Tigers men's basketball team, which has been in the news lately. They're in the Sweet 16. He was the voice of the Delaware Fighting Blue Hens women's basketball and the Advanced A Wilmington Blue Rocks in minor league baseball before taking the lead announcing role with the AAA Scranton Wilkes-Barre Rail Riders in 2013. They're in the New York Yankees organization as their AAA affiliate. Many assignments and a long list of honors for John, including recognition from Baseball America, Ballpark Digest, State Press Associations in Delaware and New Jersey, and the National Sportscasters and Sports Writers Association, among others. John, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Keith. Thank you.
And thank you again for doing this on a rare off day in the baseball season. Once things get rolling, it's rare off days are there, and it's nice to have you join us on one of those off days as you're back in Arizona right now with the Reds, of course, and did a ball game yesterday from there. But before we move into baseball, let me ask you about your big weekend in basketball this past weekend in Orlando, doing play-by-play for the NCAA men's tournament games there. That must be a great assignment.
It's one of the greatest events in sport. I'm incredibly lucky. I've been able to do that for going on nearly a decade now. It's tremendous fun, the finality of what each game represents, and the look of awe and pure joy on the faces of every player and coach, no matter what level of program. You can be from a blue blood, you can be from a program that hasn't been to the big dance in half a century, and still there are nerves, there is positivity, there's anxiety, and everything is on the line, and I am all in on it.
Your partner was Will Perdue. Have you worked a lot of games with him?
A handful, yeah. We've been together for a decent number of regular season games. I did the SEC tournament a handful of times. He, of course, was the SEC Player of the Year in 88 at Vanderbilt. And I did some fill-in games with the Chicago Bulls on TV a few years ago, and Will's main assignment is doing pre-post in the studio for the Bulls, where he won three of his four NBA titles. So, yeah, we've been together a decent amount.
Mm-hmm. And while we're in college, I'll ask you about some of the other play-by-play and color partners here a bit later. But while we're on college basketball, let me ask you about your association with Princeton, now that we're going to be reading about Princeton a lot this week as we record on March 21st and getting ready for the Sweet 16 round of the NCAA Men's Tournament. You covered them for 10 years. That's a lot of backdoor cuts, John. You saw a lot of great fundamental basketball.
very much. It's a unique shared kinship that I have with Tom McCarthy, who's the TV voice of the Philadelphia Phillies. He's been working the first four on TV last few years, does also NFL on CBS. Tom and I actually went to the same high school on the New Jersey Shore. We were separated by 10 years, and we both called Princeton basketball for a similar length of time, separated by 10 years. And during his time, he called their win over the then reigning national champion UCLA, and I got to call their last second shot by Doug Davis to beat Harvard in a one game playoff. The Ivy, remember, forever had no conference tournament, and they were tied in the season, played on a neutral floor, and that Princeton team lost to a Final Four Kentucky team on Brandon Knight's only made basket of the game.
Yes,
in a very, very close game. But the head coach who was there at the tail end of my time at Princeton was Mitch Henderson, who has been either a player or a coach on Princeton's last four wins. The iconic image from their upset of UCLA is him leaping in the air, double fists raised, screaming for joy. And now he's the head coach, and he's a tremendous guy. I adore him. He was incredibly kind to me when he came in, very welcoming and inclusive. I still text with him quasi-regularly. He also was a baseball guy. He was drafted by the Yankees, grew up playing a lot of baseball in Indiana. But it's a tremendous place. There's such a wealth of basketball knowledge and appreciation for history, a level of success, and a deference to team and more of a lack of individuality and giving for the bigger goal, which I greatly enjoy and respect the heck out of.
Yeah, and you've kind of touched on that with that answer, but I was going to ask you about the what we think of as the typical Princeton player or the typical Princeton team, and you've described some of those qualities that we might think of, but how would you describe the guys that you worked with? Because these are generally not guys that are going to have pro prospects, but clearly they can play basketball at a very high level.
Yeah, I think they're incredibly team-driven. There's a lot of concept. I think now we see a pretty great proliferation of Princeton principals, not only in the college game, but in the NBA. You know, during my time covering Princeton, Pete Carril was an advisor with the Sacramento Kings. And you can see a lot of that more conceptual basketball that is often employed in Europe becoming more mainstream. There are more teams that have fewer plays and more read-react ideas. And what Princeton historically did, which was, you know, started by Pete Carril, an outstanding Hall of Fame coach, is just taking the idea of take away the opponent's strengths and play to your own. So he was a slow down tempo guy. He was a minimal turnover guy. Every practice by anyone within the Princeton tree, if you look at Chris Mooney at Richmond, Brian Earle at Cornell, Gary Walters when he was coaching at Dartmouth, all of them start with ball handling. They'll just dribble. And they'll just work on their handle and dribble because the core elements and principles are you need to be able to do the basic basketball things. Everyone has to be able to dribble. The five man can bring it up. Everyone has to be able to shoot. You shoot a lot at a Princeton practice, and you have to be able to anticipate and read your teammate. But I think what separates this particular team, you know, one of my best friends from college succeeded me as the play-by-play guy. The analyst on the Princeton games was a captain and player. My first year doing it was his senior year. He was my longest-termed partner during my time doing those games. They just defend incredibly well. And while the Sidney Johnson team that lost narrowly to Kentucky was very good defensively, I think this team, and the Sweet 16 seems to demonstrate that, has taken that to a new level. But I also believe the Ivy for over a decade now is way more athletic than it used to be. And I don't think it gets nearly the proper respect for the level of athleticism and the quality of may not be a dozen NBA guys, but there are a lot of guys that play a long time in pro ball that are really, really good that play Ivy League basketball.
Well, you grew up, of course, in the Northeast, New York, New Jersey. Tell me about the origin of your interest in sportscasting. Being from that area, you had a lot of teams, a lot of broadcasters that you could follow, but who were the primary influences and what triggered your interest initially?
Well, to be honest, I didn't really decide on sports broadcasting until later than many others. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love sports. I played everything. I was terrible at everything. But I love playing everything. And it was a strong connection and still is to my father. You know, most conversations would eventually spill into observations, thoughts, whatever on sports. And usually the teams that, you know, I grew up in a household that rooted for in the greater New York area, but, you know, widespread throughout the country. However, I knew at age five, I would not be a pro athlete. I had a pretty direct conversation with my mom about that then. And my plans were to work somewhere in the math or sciences. That's where my strengths were. My only varsity letter in high school was on the math team. I played JV hockey. I was a rec league basketball, baseball player. I was not good, but I made my friends laugh, so they would let me play with them and, you know, pick up or house league games. And I had shifted to astrophysics by the time I was later in high school. It really intrigued me, but this was early internet. It wasn't nearly what it is now. So I used to take those big career books that were like phone books, and I would thumb through and I read about what does a physicist or astrophysicist do. And the more I learned about it, I would likely have to get a terminal degree. So I'd be in college until I'm 25 plus. Mm-hmm. I would come out saddled with some form of debt, even with scholarship help. And the nerdy research that I aspired to do, you don't really do. There's a select number that do. You're usually a part of a bigger team, and you spend most of your time soliciting for grant funding, doing other things kind of adjacent to it for the chance to maybe 1 week every 2 or 3 years engage in the research. And when I realized that, I said, I don't know if that's for me. And I was doing a research project. My AP history class, my senior year of high school, was on 20th century race relations in the United States. And at the core was, did Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier represent or influence a changing America. And the core research periodical for me was, by that point, already 4 years old, Sports Illustrated, when Arthur Ashe was named Sportsman of the Year. Mm-hmm. And he detailed Jackie's influence on his life, what he saw. And by coincidence, in that same issue of SI was this long spread on ESPN SportsCenter, which I adored. And we watched all the time. It would be on in homeroom and school. And it detailed every position, producer, director, graphics, and had a sidebar on a day in the life of the production assistant. Lowest rung on the ladder. You make no money. You work crazy hours. You do everything nobody else wants to do. And that's when it really crystallized for me, because I always thought the idea of being on air was so unlikely. There's only a handful of jobs. How many people would want to do it? I don't even know if I have a skill for it. But I said, I know I can do that job. I know I can get that job. That's a churn job. Nobody stays a PA for 10 years. They do it for 6 months or a year. They move up or they get pushed out. And that's when I said, I know I could get in doing that. And my dream would be to host. But recognizing that's unlikely, now I'm reading about these other jobs. I would be happy making any amount of money just being around it, being involved in any way. But when I went to college then with that aspiration, I did studio work and I did not love it. It was kind of predictable and rote and boring. And then I did live events and I just cherished it. Like, live event sport is unscripted. You have to be ready for anything. You're reacting. You're, you know, kind of putting into perspective what's happening. You research. You know, you're looking up both stats and humanity in advance of the game. It's real, live, in the moment drama, and that's when I really caught the bug.
Yeah, and that is a little different story than probably many in sports broadcasting who might have had a favorite announcer or favorite team that they followed at a very young age. That's probably how most of us did it, and set a goal then to want to do that, and never gave a thought to how hard it is to rise up that pyramid there and be an on-air sportscaster. But you had given it some thought then. So by the time that you arrived at doing live events, you were certain, it sounds like, at that time.
Yes, I knew that. I was very confident I could achieve some measure of success. Basically, I felt sure that it could take a few years after I graduate, but I will find full-time employment where that's my job, and I didn't care how much money I made, and I would be satisfied. And I knew that I wouldn't necessarily do that for my entire lifetime. I would want to then move up, and you know that brought about other hurdles along the way. But I knew I would do that for a certain amount of time and feel like I had succeeded, and then anything beyond that would be gravy.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked about your experience with Princeton. Of course, during that time, you're also doing a lot of baseball, and minor league baseball is kind of a unique experience. I've had it myself, 9 years with the Lexington Legends, and I enjoyed it. I never sat down to do a ball game and wished that I was somewhere else. At the same time, it's a lifestyle that a lot of people don't want to take on. What do you recall from your minor league experience, both in your development as a professional and maybe some experiences that only come with minor league baseball?
I think it's the greatest proving ground and chance to grow that our industry affords. I think if anybody's listening that has interest in announcing sports, and I say that intentionally vaguely, it doesn't even have to be play-by-play. It doesn't have to be baseball. I think you should do minor league baseball. I think minor league baseball gives you such volume of repetition in at times very challenging environments where, you know, there is no ambient crowd sound. There is no emotional thrust or feel to it. And it's generally it's some kind of web or radio based audio only for many teams still, especially at the lower levels where you would enter at. And it's you. It's a blank canvas and it's all you. And you can stumble. You can make mistakes. You can learn who you are. I always defer to the kind folks that are far more veteran than me that still to this day help me out and have for a long time. And while nobody can agree on an exact number, but you need hundreds of innings to scratch the surface of who you are. And I think that's what minor league baseball gives all of us if you're coming at it the right way. And I think most do. I had some peers that did not, just viewed it as, college 2.0. But I think if you're listening self-critically, you're challenging yourself, and you're trying to grow and get better, it's the greatest way to get better. Now, that said, most of us who do it. And there, when I did it, was a wide spectrum. Post-COVID, I think it's changed radically. So I fall shy of trying to give any real declarations of what it's like now, because I only hear secondhand, and it's a really, really wide range. But the money was generally not good to horrendous, sometimes none, depending upon what position you were in. And that's a blunt reality. You know, I was a Division II SID at an HBCU conference in Greater Atlanta. I was making pretty good money. And I had a really nice apartment. I was told I would have a chance to be on air some there, which never quite materialized. But it was overall a good life. And I could have springboarded that into something perhaps equal or better. And then I had a chance instead to be on the air in A-ball to make $1,200 a month before taxes. And I wound up living in my aunt's basement. And thank goodness the team happened to be 15 minutes from where my aunt lived. If it weren't there, Keith, I don't know if I could have taken it. If it were, in North Dakota, if it were in Texas, or we're in California, I would not have had the money, and my family doesn't have the money, to just pay rent. And that's hard. That's really hard for a lot of young folks that start beginning in it. And I think, unfortunately, it crosses out the opportunity for a number of people that don't have that, don't have the financial assistance for it. And you wind up, you're eating the free breakfast in whatever usually mediocre or bad hotel you're staying in. Yes. You're on a bus that almost all of us have been on, one that's broken down multiple times during the course of the year. And you miss everything. I mean, to me, that's the biggest thing. When you first start, if you're really young, it's not as challenging because there aren't as many life events if you're in your early mid-20s. But the longer you do it, and I did it for 15 years, I missed friends' weddings. Mm-hmm. I missed, baptisms. I missed funerals because I had work. And it's very hard to have a significant other. It's very hard for them to understand, listen, are you serious? You're going to leave again? Do you have to do this game? Well, yeah, it's my job. And that's one of the blunt realities of our industry, even more than necessarily with a single team, more as you try to grow in the freelance world, particularly in television. You always have to say yes. You can say no, but no, the first time you say no, when that opportunity comes up again, you're probably not going to be the first call. And the likelihood of someone else saying no and then coming back to you is not very high. And that's difficult to bridge personal and professional life.
That's absolutely true. And I remember reading a story a few years ago about Jack Buck, and another about Mel Allen. And these guys had what seemed like brutal schedules, but they didn't want to turn down an assignment because somebody else would get it, and then the call would not come the next time. So, there is that pressure, too. And there is a lot that you miss during that time. My own experience, I was at the other end. My kids were grown when I took it on. But still, that is a factor. Certainly a factor for everyone who lives the baseball life. On the plus side, of course, you get some great experience, and I learned too that they're just some great people in baseball, and I really enjoyed meeting a lot of them and getting to know them a little better, especially on the road. That afforded that opportunity. But I'm sure along the lines there, you must have met some wonderful people that may still be in your life. Sometimes baseball brings you back around to somebody too after a period of years, but there are some great associations you can make.
Oh, very much. Yeah, the probably my favorite manager during that time, and particularly for me, I was both at each of my stops, I was the play-by-play guy and the media relations PR man, which is not universally the case. It depends upon the team. So I was always the one to have to grab the manager for an interview with a local newspaper person, to ask about probables for an upcoming series to put in the game notes and share with the other team and be that go-between. We had Al Padrique as our manager my last few years in AAA. He famously was the interim with Arizona when he decided to walk Barry Bonds for a series. He also famously was the greatest endorser and scout of Jose Altuve and insisted that the Astros – take a chance on a man of diminutive stature that he insisted can hit and would be a good hitter in the big leagues. One of the kindest, sweetest men that I've ever come across. Serious, asks of his team, challenges them. He's going to manage in Double-A this year with the Phillies, but last couple of years he had been with the Marlins. And so my first year doing Reds games, of course, we were not allowed in clubhouses. We couldn't travel. So last year was my first chance. I went down to the Marlins clubhouse to see him, and we had a handshake and a hug, and it was really cool to see him back in the big leagues again, where he had been before in various roles, enjoying that opportunity and to be there with him and just be like, wow, remember we were in Syracuse on a Monday night after a rainout, and there were a crowd of 500 people, and here we are sitting in a big league ballpark. There are hundreds of people like that. And there, you could attest to this, there are just as many that nobody listening to this would recognize mm-hmm. that never made it to the big leagues, that were super talented, that were great people, and for XYZ reason it didn't click. We're on a cruise with my wife and her extended family. We're in Key West. We're walking around in Key West, and I see a guy walking by with a ball cap of the A-ball team that I had worked for years earlier. And I do a double take, and I realize that's Brett Bigler. That's the corner outfielder from the Blue Rocks. So I run him down. I said, Brett. And he turns around, and it turns out that he had married a woman who was from that area, who went to the same high school as my wife and her sister.
Oh, wow.
And knew my sister-in-law. And here we are bumping into each other in Key West. And we're able to, you know, spend about 10 minutes and share stories and say hello and find out who he's still talking to from that group and give updates on people. And it's really, really fun.
Yeah, it's amazing how often that will continue to happen, I'm sure, throughout your however many years you spend in baseball. That those kinds of things will happen from time to time. Well, let me ask you one more non-baseball question, actually. Jump away to football for just a second before we get to the Reds. But you do a lot of NFL games. The preparation, it seems, must be just really extensive to get ready to do an NFL game on radio.
I would say, actually, I think NFL on radio is pretty easy, relatively, to prepare for. I find it's much harder to do college, chiefly because there's just so few players. You already know them. I don't have to give, background info of any tremendous depth on Lamar Jackson. I'm really talking about the trends going into that moment in that game. Why does it matter today? What's the story today? And then there's immediate recall of, major moments that have happened for him that I can reference, and I don't have to go too deep into a story. Because if you watch the NFL, you're pretty aware. If you're doing particularly like SEC football, where they will rotate good teams, 10 to 12 defensive linemen will all play, and any one of them can make a play, and many in your audience might not know a ton about them. That's where the preparation is more akin to what I do think is tough. I had one summer I had a chance to do preseason NFL on TV. Kevin Kugler normally does the Houston Texans. He was doing Olympic basketball for Westwood One that summer. So I wound up doing several of the Texans preseason games. That is similar because there are just so many guys, especially in those first couple of games, that you have to be aware of. And some come from not as well covered of backgrounds, depending upon their level of collegiate schooling and what's been written about them in terms of features, especially linemen. And that's where you have to do a lot more digging. We do more face-to-face interviews. And don't get me wrong, you prep, and it's double-digit hours to get ready for a game. But I think NFL, particularly on radio, because it's really built for broadcast. Down and distance, time and score, formation, play, analyst repeat. And in between, we have a lot of reads and promos. And so there's a limited window to how many stories you can really tell. It's really more about the person in the car, I think, wants to know what's the score, where's the ball, what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. So you have to be visually descriptive, but the prep isn't quite the same level. Where if I'm doing a college game, if it's more obscure programs or if it's a major program that plays a lot of guys, that's probably 1.5 to 2 times as much hours of prep to get ready for that game.
Well, you are a well-seasoned broadcaster by the time that you joined the Reds, but that in itself was quite a story as we were going through the COVID year. But tell me about how it all came about with the Reds and resolved with you signing on and taking on this big league voice of one team as a TV broadcaster.
Well, that was my dream, was to call games for a team. I thought baseball and NBA were where my skill set, background, abilities would line up the best. And I had several near misses with teams in both leagues. Some I was very close, and I was emotionally devastated when it didn't happen. So when my agent called and said, hey, how would you like to interview for the Cincinnati Reds TV job? My honest, immediate reaction was, okay, yeah, that sounds great. And he was grossly disappointed and called me out on it. He's like, "What? Why aren't you really pumped about this?" And I said, well, I've been really close all these other times. And almost every other time I knew a major decision maker. I knew a significant voice of influence in the hire, and I fell short. And I don't know anybody. So in my mind, I'm just imagining they probably want to interview three or five or whatever their number is, and I'm the third or fifth person because my background kind of lines up. But someone in that one of the other choices is going to know somebody, and they're going to get the job, and I'm not. Because as I've seen a lot over the course of time, not universally, but generally, like most industries, those that are the most connected either get in the room or outright get the job. And that doesn't mean they're not qualified or capable. It's just that's how they cut down on the hundreds, sometimes thousands of people that apply for certain positions. And so I thought my chances were close to zero. And I told him, like, I'm going to try. I want it. But I was almost emotionally preparing myself because I got so invested and I was so convinced that I was right on the verge before that it crippled me. I mean, there were two of those times where I cried because I thought I was there. And it came short, and I didn't want to get hurt again, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to be ready for it. And then the process went on, and you know, I advance around. I speak to the GM of the TV network. I talk to a member of the ownership group. I speak with a number of other team executives. And with each passing rung, that's when I started to believe more and more. And I thought, I think this can actually happen. And then when I got the call that I got the job, I was just over the moon excited. And it was COVID. So we were doing a basketball game remotely from essentially like a loading dock building in North Jersey outside of New York. It looked like Tony Soprano might have stuffed somebody inside of a garbage dumpster outside. And we're about to record our open. And I get a phone call from the agent. And I asked my producer, I'm like, I really need to take this. Can I step away, please, for like 2 minutes? He said, yeah, it's fine. And I get that information, and then I immediately called my wife, and I like, listen, I have like 30 seconds because I have to go back in and record the open, and I just blurted it out, and I don't know that I've ever called a game with a greater sense of pregame emotional high than that one. Like that game could have ended 2-0, and I would have been as ecstatic and elated as possible, because it was a dream realized.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, then now a couple of years in, you've worked with partners like Chris Welsh and Barry Larkin. Did it take you a little while to settle in or obviously, again, referring to your extensive experience by that time, were you able to find your footing pretty quickly?
I think both. I think we're always settling in to some extent. I think if you're not challenging yourself to be better, if you're not trying to improve in some way, then you're getting worse. So I have a circle of friends that are announcers, many in baseball with other mostly major league teams at this point. Some are with minor league teams still, whose opinions I significantly respect. And I think they're very good game callers, and they're honest with me. And many of us, we all know each other. It's this interconnected web of people that kind of graduated and moved up together. And we'll give each other tape feedback, and I'll ask them, like, hey, can you watch this half inning of this game? And was I over the top here? Should I have done something differently here? And I don't always agree, but I welcome the feedback, and I think it helps keep me honest. At the same time, yeah, I think if you can be prepared to do games where it's literally friends and family that are the general audience, and there are times when there's 100 people in the stands, and you can do it at least, you know, to your own satisfaction relatively well, then doing a big league game is so much easier on so many levels. There are people that care more, that gives you an intrinsic greater sense of responsibility. There's abundant information, way, way, way more that's available for every game. And all you have to do is just caption moments. I think, you know, TV and radio are very different mediums. And most of my minor league experience was radio. This is entirely television. And while the skill sets don't always transition for all of us, I think TV on a relative level is easier, especially if you have good partners. And I'm really blessed with the situation that we have in Cincinnati. Chris and Barry and Jeff Brantley and Sam LaCure are incredibly kind to me, really, really helpful, both on air and off. And I couldn't ask for a better situation.
Well, let's talk for a moment about the 2023 Cincinnati Reds as we record here on March 21st, just a few days shy of opening day. And, of course, Reds fans are in need of some hope. There are some really good young players on the team. Of course, everybody developing at the same time, kind of long odds on that. But at the same time, there is some talent there. What stands out to you after having a look here in two or three weeks of spring training?
I think the biggest standout is the core three starters, between Hunter Green, Nick Lodolo, and Graham Ashcraft. I think history would tell us that usually in this situation for a sophomore season, between three young stars like that, that had largely good, but each of them in their own way up and down first years, one would kind of stay where he is or take a step forward. One would kind of yo-yo, go up and down, whether by production or injury, and one would take a big step back and either be hurt or non-productive. And the return so far this spring, all three look better. Hunter is aggressive and commanding, and the breaking ball is a sharper finishing pitch. Nick Lodolo's changeup is being thrown more often and even more effectively. I think his arm angle for that back foot slider has been truer. I thought he took a big step as we record this yesterday with six innings and eight strikeouts. And perhaps the greatest growth has come from Graham Ashcraft, who honestly, when I saw him at Reds Fest, he said he was working on a split change. He needed a third pitch. You know, the two-seamer and the cut fastball are excellent, but the breaking ball he threw last year was okay. And at times it felt like a show-me pitch that if it were in the zone was a bit of a hanger that could be clobbered. And the split change sounded like the perfect complement. And then I read in the paper, a month or two later, that he had decided to abandon it. It wasn't quite going right, but he had found something in a grip with his breaking ball that was working. And my instant honest reaction, I was a little worried. I thought, I hope it's not the same breaking ball as last year. And Keith, it looks sensational. His start, two starts ago against the Dodgers, his first two innings were the best I've ever seen him pitch. He was an easy 98 plus, commanding at a fairly good level. And the breaking ball was crippling. And there were several good Dodgers regulars that were in there. And then he had the leg injury, which in the moment you're really worried. He's leaving the game. Thankfully, it turns out to just be a cramp in his calf. But then my eyes go to his next start. How does he pitch the next time? Can he give length? And he goes four innings, and he took what he did in those first two and goes another step. And he's even more dominating and overwhelming. And you can read it in the swings and the body language of the hitters that he's facing. To me, that's the core story of this team right now, is that those three young pitchers are super talented. They are focused. I think they playfully and respectfully challenge and lift up each other with their effort level and results. And to me, that's what I'm looking for. When I get approached by Reds fans in the ballpark here in Goodyear, and they ask for kind of what you're asking for, like, what are your thoughts on the team? And they're either directly or indirectly saying, like, give me a reason for hope. Give me a reason for optimism. I tell them, I think there's going to be a compelling reason to watch this team pretty much every day, and it's going to be led by those three young men. They're not going to win every game those guys pitch. They're going to have some trouble scoring runs. I do think that. But I do think those three are super talented, and I'm highly encouraged by what they have shown this spring.
And while we've talked about some young talent here, there are some veterans around, too. And Joey Votto is back and trying to get on track now as spring training comes to a conclusion. Will Myers is with the Reds now and hit a home run in yesterday's ball game. Again, we're recording on March 21st. Kevin Newman was a pretty capable ball player in Pittsburgh for several years. So there is some experience out there to blend with some of these young players, isn't there?
There is, and perhaps the name that has intrigued me the most, because Will Myers to me is a known commodity. I mean, Joey Votto's Joey Votto. He's coming off a major surgery and injury, but if there's anyone who knows his body and will put in the work to get through it, it is Joey. But the name that I didn't really know much about was Will Benson, who they brought in through trade from Cleveland, first-round pick, super athletic, covers tremendous ground in the outfield, can run the bases incredibly well. I'd love to see a flat foot race between him and Ellie De La Cruz. And looks pretty good at the plate. He had an opposite way home run into the wind in Peoria against Seattle. And Dave Sims is a longtime veteran announcer who was very kind to me. He was the first big league guy to give me extended tape feedback when I was an A-ball. And we've kept in touch over the course of the years. He said that balls generally do not travel to that direction in that stadium. And that was an opposite way home run. Benson's hitting numbers in the big leagues were not very good last year. And his minor league numbers for most of his career were not very good. Last year, AAA in Columbus, he hit fairly well. His spring, he has looked very good at the plate. He is a plus defender. Throwing arm is not great, but everything else he brings, the seriousness that he has, the competition level, and he's still only 24 years old. It feels a lot like the Reds' acquisition of Tyler Naquin, except I think he's a plus defensively. And I think he, both average and power-wise, could match or exceed what Naquin gave the Reds at a more premier defensive position. To me, he's one of the critical pieces that has really blossomed in the spring, that he's going to have a chance. And if he can hit against big league pitching during the course of the year, especially Great American Ballpark, that is a major boon for the Reds to have him in center.
I have to ask you the pace of play question as changes are made this year to try to speed things up. The pitch clock, of course, and then the bigger bases to encourage more stolen bases. Will we see a little different look to baseball this year? And have you seen some evidence of that in the spring training games that you've covered?
Decidedly, yes. Stolen base frequency and the number of steal attempts and how successful they are has gone up dramatically. We're only a few years removed from the Reds being dead last in stolen base number of attempts and percentage of time that they got in. And they, as of yesterday, they were 30 of 35 in stolen base tries. And opponents, by the way, were 23 of 26. I think the stolen base is going to become a bigger part of the game, especially in later game situations. I think as relievers learn the cat and mouse game with the disengagement rule, that's a big deal. The bases, I do think that marginally influences that. I think it's more the pitch clock and the disengagement that's helping to bring up the stolen base number to showcase the great athleticism that today's player has. And the pitch clock is awesome. I understand those that protest the concept of it. All I would ask you is watch it for a few games. Because I also believe that the number of violations are going to be close to nil as the year goes on. We saw that in the minors when it was truly implemented last year. The rate of violations dropped dramatically as the year went on. We've already seen that to some extent in spring training. They're getting a full look at it in spring training. For most players, it will not be an issue. It's just going to make them play faster. They don't even have to look at the clock. That's just going to be the way they play for both pitchers and for hitters. And I think it's just making the game look like what it did decades ago. Yeah, the game got away from itself because there was value in that, perceived at least, and I think some of it actual, for both pitcher and hitter. The pitcher, more time to rest to be truly max effort, particularly with the relievers, if they're only going out for one inning. The hitter to try to get a greater sense of comfort and to try to disrupt the pitcher. But what are we losing? We're losing the guy doing a lap of the mound looking up at the sky. We're losing the 15 adjustments of the batting glove. To me, we're losing nothing. We're getting more action. We're getting the ball pitched and the ball in play, and I think that's a good thing.
Well, all that action is coming up very soon, the regular season variety. A final question, John. How important is it for this team to get off to a good start this year? Because last year was such a disaster at the start, it's easy for fans to lose hope very early. But what's the importance of this early stage of the season?
It's enormous, and it's something that David Bell has bluntly talked about himself multiple times. The crippling start to last year was horrendous. It was really, really difficult to go through a stretch like that. I thought this team rebounded because they played several months of about 500 ball thereafter, and then the finish was similar to the start of the season. It's gigantic, and I think exactly because it happened last year. Independently, it was an incredible challenge to go through last season. But I think if you follow up a year with that exact same kind of start, which I would have to think is incredibly hard to do, it's really unlikely for all those circumstances to come together to have that horrid a record in the first month of the year, I think is terribly unlikely. But yeah, I mean, it does make it a factor, and that's going to be part of a psychological balance, because if you do lose a game or two, that could start to creep into your mind. Yes, it is a giant deal to start well, at the very least to avoid a really rough start, because the schedule out of the gate is not the easiest. Your first road trip, you're going to Philly and Atlanta. Those are two really good teams. So, yes, I think that is a big, big point.
Well, we hope you and the Reds have a great 2023 season. And again, John, thanks so much for taking time to do this, and wish you well and have a great 2023.
Thank you kindly, Keith. Really appreciate it.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.